Like I said, we're going to start a subject in anthropology. Anthropology, is the study of humanity. Anthropos, from the Greek, which means human. What is a human being? This is one of those questions that is absolutely vitally important to a great many things about your life, but that a lot of people don't often think about a great deal. And just because you don't think about something doesn't mean it's not going to affect you. This is important that oftentimes the things that you're about. Yeah. Okay. Actually, sometimes the things that you believe without realizing you believe them, without thinking about the fact that you believe them, can impact you far more than a belief that you have consciously chosen. Why study anthropology? Sometimes in some versions of, sometimes you will hear Christians say a thing like, it's not about you, it's about God. You ever heard a Christian say that? You heard somebody say, it's not about you, it's about God. And I understand what they're doing. You know, there are those versions of Christianity sometimes referred to as moralistic therapeutic deism, right? Which is just all about how for you to have your best life and feel better about yourself and so forth. And don't really have much of anything to do with the glory of God or God's will or anything like that. And so as they are trying to just distance themselves and kind of refute that idea, I get it. I get that. But in doing so, they engage in a false dichotomy, for one thing. Christianity is absolutely about you. It is absolutely about you. And about God. right at the beginning of Calvin's Institutes, he makes the statement that you cannot understand God without understanding yourself, and you can't understand yourself without understanding God. That those two knowledges are mutually dependent. Because we are made in the image of God. Now we're going to talk about what that means. The Heidelberg Catechism, first question of the Heidelberg Catechism is, what is your only comfort in life and in death? It starts with you. What is your only comfort in life and in death? Westminster Larger Catechism starts the same way. I mean, it comes at it from a different angle, but it says, what is the chief end of man? Like, what is the purpose of man? What is the point of you? You know, as the kids say. What is the point of you? What is your purpose? That's what anthropology seeks to get at. To understand biblical anthropology. Of course, anthropology is a study of science. You know, you can go to the university and take classes in anthropology, which would probably contain a lot of interesting and useful information, but which would be likely to be coming at the question from a very different perspective, with a different set of assumptions. What you think a human being is going to have profound impact on the way you live your life. You know, there's a book I read recently, by Carl Truman, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. And in that book, he starts out by saying, okay, so the whole idea, you know, the statement, like somebody would say, I am a woman trapped in a man's body. 20 years ago, when I was a kid, that was a joke. It would just be a joke. It would be a ridiculous thing you would say. Now, in just that period of time, this idea is not only not a joke, but is so firmly believed by so many that if you deny that such a thing is possible, you are as bad as a Nazi. You are literally Hitler, right? For denying that such an idea makes any sense. Why is it that question, for example, has become has gone from being something that was worthy of ridicule to something that was absolutely undeniable orthodoxy in our culture in such a short period of time? The answer is anthropology. What you think a human being is. The Bible offers a fundamentally different set of assumptions about what a human being is than what the world thinks a human being is. Not that the world thinks one thing about what a human being is. There are actually a number of alternate and competing anthropologies existing in the world, and we're going to talk about some of those today. To jump ahead, and building off of what Calvin said, though, it is impossible to understand what a human being is. And this actually flows from the last unit we had, right? We talked about covenant, right? Covenant is necessary to anthropology, to right and proper anthropology. It is, in order to understand what a human being is, you first have to understand that that man was created in a particular relationship with God. You cannot understand the nature of a human being unless you understand that truth. That man was created to be in relationship with God. And that relationship is defined in a particular way. Everything about what a human being flows from that truth. If you deny that man is in relationship to God, then you have to define man in some other way. And human philosophers have taken a number of stabs at that over the years. The whole debate over transgenderism is just one example of that. There are lots and lots of implications, for what you think a human being is. And it's one of the reasons we often talk past each other when we're having these kinds of discussions is because we're not actually recognizing the fundamental differences. We're using different language. We're saying different things. We think we're using the same terminology when we're talking to people about these issues. There simply is no point in talking to someone else about abortion, for example, unless you can establish some commonalities about human nature. If you have fundamentally different understandings of what human nature is, you're never going to agree about abortion, for example. You know, or the purpose of government. Lots of other things. So that's just to give you a little bit of a taste of what it is that we're wanting to do. Fundamentally, you know, again, the idea of God, man being created in relation to God, and man being given a particular nature as a result of that. Man is created in the image of God. Right? That truth is fundamental to the biblical understanding of anthropology. One of the things that means, by the way, is that the historicity of the first three chapters of Genesis are essential to a biblical anthropology. If you deny the historicity of the first three chapters of Genesis, you're going to really struggle to have a biblical anthropology in the rest of your thinking. Any questions or anything so far? Like I said, that's just kind of an introduction. Let's talk about, before we're going to spend the rest of the, you know, spend a lot of time talking about biblical anthropology, but I want to talk a little bit about, just to lay the foundation of some of other views of anthropology. The pagan views, the old pagan view, they believe that God had created man. They would not have understood something like the idea that man was created in the image of God, however. Their views of the creation of man tend to be pretty degraded. That man was created into a a pretty degraded state. You remember, like in the Greek, you know the Greek myth of Prometheus, right? He was one of the titans that brought fire to man and was cursed by the gods as a result. That story right there tells you an awful lot about the pagan view of mankind. That man was created actually in a pretty low state. They were created in order to be dependent on the gods and to offer sacrifice. They were basically like the support system for the gods. The gods needed a sort of sustenance that they received from man's worship. And so the gods created man, and they wanted to create man in this kind of low dependent state so that man would be constantly praying to God and worshiping God and offering the gods sacrifices, because the gods needed that for nourishment. That's why they were so disturbed by Prometheus bringing fire to man. The pagan stories tend to start out with man being created as a sort of an afterthought, as sort of a not the pinnacle of creation, but just sort of, the gods made all this, this great world. And then at a certain point they said, oh, we're going to need somebody to offer sacrifice, so let's do this, you know. And it's just sort of, and man starts out in this kind of low degraded state, but through man's own efforts, man's heroic struggle, man arises and betters himself and makes him so that man ends up coming into conflict with the gods as a result. That's all the pagan stories follow these similar patterns. I think there are echoes of the flood and the Tower of Babel and a lot of those stories. The other thing to know about the pagan cosmology and the pagan view of man is that the gods are not eternal. In the pagan cosmology, only the universe is eternal. The matter and stuff of the universe, that goes on forever, and they go through these very long cycles whether it's Norse mythology, Greek mythology, Egyptian, Chinese. You see these same patterns, Hinduism, where there are long, billions of years of nothingness and chaos, where there is no life. There's no intelligence. There's no form to anything. There's just chaos. Out of that chaos, out of that primordial chaos, over long periods of time, somehow some principle emerges. Some order, some intelligence. And that's God, or the gods. And this, Zeus, it was Kronos, or one of the Titans, because the Zeus or those gods are always the children of the Titans. That's, again, a very similar, you have the Titans in Greek mythology or Roman mythology. You've got the frost giants in Norse mythology. So there's this early race of gods that arises out of the primordial chaos, brings some sort of order, creates the world, creates the things in the world. The second generation of gods comes out and overthrows the first, because the first generation of gods is always evil. And the second generation overthrows them and brings a more benevolent rule. But it's still a tyrannical rule. The gods exist for the, the statement in King Lear that the fool makes at a certain point. As flies are to little boys, so are we to the gods. They kill us for their sport. Okay? That's a very good representation of the pagan view of life. The pagan view of that, in their mind, they weren't a special creation by God who loved them. They were a sort of an afterthought. They were created into a degraded state. They're not essentially different than the gods. Both the gods and human beings arose out of the same primordial chaos, ultimately. And both the gods and human beings will one day go back to that primordial chaos. Because those cycles just endlessly repeat. Only the universe is eternal, and the universe is impersonal. The universe doesn't care about you. The gods created you, but even then they sort of created you in principle. They created the idea of human beings, but human beings arose then naturally. And the gods created the human beings for their own selfish purpose, not necessarily to, they didn't create them into a good state. It was man's own efforts that raised his status to a higher and better state. Now, so what does that mean? That means ultimately, what is the purpose of my existence? Well, you don't have one. There isn't really one. And if that's the case, if you don't really have a purpose for your existence, then it's up to you to decide. You have the meaning that you give your own life. You decide for yourself what the meaning of your existence is. And so the pagans held most of humanity in contempt and believed that suffering was the natural lot of human existence. But there were these certain heroes. There were these certain people who, through their own effort or their bloodlines or their, maybe they were half God or something like that, could arise to a higher level. And through that, those particular people become deified. Those people become gods themselves. Because again, it's all on a kind of a chain of existence. You can move up the chain of existence. You can move down the chain of existence. That's explicit in Hinduism and its idea of reincarnation and so forth. But that idea was implicit in a lot of the ancient religions. Ultimately, life is absurd. Absurd means it has no meaning. It has no purpose. They joke about like you're learning ancient languages. Any of you ever studied an ancient language like Latin or Greek or anything like that? And you know how somebody made a joke about like learning an ancient language as opposed to learning a modern language. And learning a modern language is like, hello, sir, where is the bathroom? I am trying to find the subway, right? And learning ancient languages is all examples like, the raiders came over the mountains and destroyed our village and enslaved my wife, stuff like that, because that was the ancient world. I mean, the ancient world was just misery. The philosophers, Aristotle himself, said that human existence is suffering and the goal of human existence is to escape human existence. To somehow transcend human life, because human life was just suffering. Because it was absurd. Had no meaning. The only meaning, therefore, the gods had the purpose for making you, but their purpose was selfish and malevolent. So why should you... The idea, worshiping gods as his beloved father who loves you, that's very much a Christian idea. There were the gods, and you read the stories. I mean, Zeus was a rapist. And that was okay because he was powerful. So he had the right to. That's where all those, like Hercules and Achilles, those are all the offspring of Zeus's dalliances with human women, right? So if you were to transcend that degraded kind of miserable state, you had to decide for yourself what your life meant and give your own life meaning usually through heroic achievements and accomplishments. Okay? That makes sense? In the Chinese, one of the Chinese creation myths, the goddess, I forget her name, but she decides to create mankind, and so she gathers up the mud from the Yellow River and she carefully crafts these beautiful figures, right, out of that mud, and breathes her life into them and they become people. And she does that for a little while, but she gets bored. It's a lot of work, time consuming, right? But she hasn't made as many people as she wants to make. So then she just takes her stick, her staff, and she dips it in the mud of the Yellow River and just kind of flings it around. And those drops that go, those chunks of mud that land around, those become the rest of the people. And the one that she spends all her time carefully crafting, those are like the noblemen and the high-born people. And the chunks of thrown about mud that just kind of land wherever, that's everybody else. That's the peasants, right? That's a great example of the way that, there are the heroes, there are the people who, through whatever personal virtue they have chosen to rise above the status of miserable humanity to transcend that. And then there's the peasants, the rest of them, that who cares about them? That's pretty much pagan cosmology right there. You can see how very different Christianity was already, right? You can see some major differences. As paganism got more philosophical and sophisticated, which, really interestingly, I think, happened in a lot of these civilizations, Greece, India, China, Iran, the Zoroastrians, happened right about the same time that the Jews would have been dispersed into all of those places. Make of that what you will. But the paganism in all these places started to get more sophisticated, started to get more philosophical, started to get more concerned with eternity, started to see the value of the individual more, started to think about eternal life and the soul and things like that. Hinduism, Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, Platonism all arise in that whole part of the world right about the same time. I do think it's interesting to note those things did not just happen naturally as a sort of an evolution. They happened at a particular time, in a particular place. It did not, for example, happen in North and South America, which had no contact with either Judaism or Christianity. The Aztecs were still worshiping, were still sacrificing children to their blood gods in 1500 AD, right? Oxford University is older than the Aztec Empire. Okay. And yet they hadn't changed at all. Right? So anyway, that, like I said, that's just interesting to me. But so they started to think more in Hinduism, Buddhism, Platonism. You see ideas, and I have here really at this point you have a divergence. You have two different big camps of thought on the nature of reality and the nature of the human being. And one of them is, you could think of as pantheistic or panentheistic. And this basically states everything is God, or everything is an emanation of God. In either of these accounts, still, God, that is, God, is not personal. God's more like a principle, a force. And the universe either is equal to God. God is the universe. The universe is God. Shinto, for example, in China, everything is the divine, right? And so you see the divine. The divine is not necessarily good or bad. The divine just is. Sometimes when people, when you look at like Japanese mythology or Chinese mythology, and there are demons everywhere, and think, well, demons, that must be evil. But they weren't. They were just their own thing. They were just neutral. They just didn't want to be bothered, and they didn't want you to mess with their particular shrine or mountain or river or whatever. That was their river. That was their mountain. They just wanted you to stay. And they would be very evil to you if you went in and dirtied up their mountain, but otherwise they didn't care. Because the whole world was divine, and that divinity was seen in the expression of spirits and demons and fairies and pixies and gods and all that kind of thing, right? And they were everywhere. And that was true in a lot. And so that coming to a full understanding, coming to a higher understanding of reality is to see that everything is divine. If everything is divine, then I am divine, right? And for me to think of myself as merely human or material or an animal or a higher animal or something like that is to fail to see what I really am. So that salvation is looking inward to find the divine within me, to find my connection to the divine. Hinduism, for example, explicitly teaches that individual existence is suffering. Individual existence is illusion. For you to think of yourself as an individual. You know the old joke about, you know, when the Dalai Lama goes to buy a hot dog, and how does he order? Well, he says, I'll take one with everything. One with everything. Because that's like the, right? Because that's what they believe that true wisdom comes when you realize is that what they call the principle of non-duality. That anytime you distinguish one thing from another, you distinguish yourself from another person. That's an illusion. Wisdom comes when I see that I am the same as you and you are, not that I am the same kind of thing that has common experiences and sufferings, but that we are literally the same thing. To think of us as distinct individuals is an illusion, and it is that illusion which causes all human suffering. In fact, for me to think of myself as distinct from the earth, from animals, from God, is an illusion and is the cause of suffering. That's the principle of non-duality that Hinduism and to some great degree, well, that's actually explicitly Buddhist. The Hindus think very similarly, though, that everything is God, and that wisdom and salvation come when you realize that, so that you can escape this whole cycle of, because the whole reason you suffer is because you have desires. You have desires, you want this or that, you want more pleasure, you want more money, but if you realize, really, you realize you already have all pleasure and all money and all wealth and all contentment. You also have none of those things. You are everything and nothing at the same time. That's Buddhism, right? That's pantheism or panentheism. Now, pantheism and panentheism can be distinguished a little bit. They're similar principles. Panentheism comes from the Greek panentheo, which just means everything in God. So panentheism distinguishes between the world and God, but that the world is an emanation from God. The world flows naturally out of God. It would deny the idea that God is a distinct personal entity that makes a choice to create the world. Again, God is simply sort of like a divine force. And out of that divine force emanates all of reality. But again, it's the reality falls into the illusion and the failure of thinking that it is separate from God, and that is the source of its suffering. That we have lost touch with our divine essence, and that's why we suffer. Salvation comes when I look within myself to rediscover my divine essence, so that I can be reunited with my source. Again, it's real similar to pantheism. They're kind of lumped together, but there is a distinction. Panentheism, that word was Alfred Lord Whitehead, who was an English philosopher of the late 19th, early 20th century. Some other guys popularized that term. But you see that all the way back in especially Hinduism. Hinduism is not one monolithic thing. There's lots of different versions of Hinduism. You see a lot of that in the Eastern Orthodox Church. You see a lot of that in modern liberal Christianity and in the New Age movements. Very common in New Age thinking. Again, the idea of recognizing we are all emanations of the divine, and salvation comes when I look within myself to see the divinity that is within me. And again, I am the one that defines that. I am the one that comes to understand and experience that. That's up to me to see. Now you can see why, and this idea that panentheism especially is really, really popular today. Really popular. There are a lot of people that talk that way, a lot of people that the sort of person that describes themselves as not religious but spiritual is almost certainly some variety of panentheist. You know, believing that they believe in the divine, they believe that they flow from the divine in some sense. They might even express some of this in what sounds like Christian language. There's a theology known as process theology, for example, which is very popular in some liberal circles, a liberal wing of Christianity. Process theology is the idea that it's all about the process. You ever heard somebody say, it's about the journey, it's not about the destination? You hear that one? It's about the journey, it's not about the... That sounds just true enough that it's really... Because it's inspiring, isn't it? It's like we're all engaged in the struggle, and the struggle is necessary, and that's true. But no, it's about the destination. No, scripturally, it's very much about the destination. It's about the ideal to which we are being brought, right? It's about that state of perfection, that state of being in perfect conformity to the image of God. If it's about the journey and not the destination, the destination, see, that focuses me on God. God as the goal. God as the standard, the benchmark. If it's about the journey, well, now that's about me. Because it's about my experience and my struggle and my process. In process theology, God is just as much part of the process. He's in process as well. Right? So it's like we're in it together. We're part of the same. He's changing too. He's learning and growing through us. Some people talk about, there are versions of this that talk about the incarnation in a particular way. Sometimes you'll hear things like incarnational theology, which if you're not careful, can really get you into this. It's the idea that just as Jesus is incarnate in a human being, so God is incarnate in the human race. And so God has put himself in a position, he's voluntarily chosen to change and learn and grow along with humanity. The Roman Catholic Church teaches this ever since John Paul. John Paul taught, and this is why they can view tradition the way that they do, is that Jesus is just as dependent on his church as the church is dependent on Jesus, right? Jesus learns and grows through the church just as the church learns and grows through Jesus, right? And they overplay the analogy of husband and wife. A husband and wife ought to be mutual and listen to one another and grow from one another. And Christ is the husband, the church is the bride, and therefore that would be true of Christ in the church as well. Which is why they can say, which is why you can point out places where the Roman Catholic Church's tradition will contradict previous tradition, and that won't bother them at all. They'll say, yeah, that John Paul II said explicitly this, that the Christ is just as dependent on the process of the church learning as the church is dependent on Christ. Process theology. Panentheism. Because you see how then God is not, God is, the world, if the world emanates from God, the world is, the world is the divine energies of God. In the Eastern Orthodox Church, for example, the goal of salvation is divinization, to be made deity in the Eastern Orthodox Church, to be made divine. Now, they make a distinction in order to answer their Western Church critics that this is just panentheism. And they say, well, there's a distinction between the essence of God and the energies of God. So we don't share in the energies of God. We don't share in the essence of God, but we do share in the energies of God. And all creation is the energies of God. And not God's actions and working in the world, but like his actual energies, part of his own nature. And salvation is achieved when I come to see that I share in those energies, which you do through the means of grace that the church provides. And so that the goal is divinization. That is panentheism. It also explains, by the way, it explains, relevant to current events, it explains why Putin's promotion of Christianity in Russia should not be anything that Protestant Christians are excited about. You know, because the version of Christianity he is promoting is not anything biblical. It's one that views itself in the church as subservient to the state. And that flows right out of this panentheistic view. If man is divinized through salvation, what's the highest emblem of man? Or what's the highest highest example of man's own energies? They're in the state. So that the state becomes the divinization of God. Which is why the church has always served the interests of empire in the Eastern Church. So Putin is promoting Christianity. He's promoting a particular version of Christianity, which can be used as a tool of his own power. And such things have typically led to tremendous murder and suffering in the past. And he also suppresses, persecutes, Protestant Christianity wherever he sees it, because Protestant theology strongly limits the power of the state in lots of ways. So anyway, side note. So pantheism or panentheism was an ancient, you see it especially in Neoplatonism, later versions of Hinduism and Buddhism, the idea that the world or creation is either equal to God or the emanations of God, that everything is divine, that we especially are divine, all human beings are divine. One of the things you see that this does is the versions of Christianity which follow something like this end up completely destroying the uniqueness of Christ. Christ's experience of incarnation is something we all need to experience. We all become incarnate like he was, instead of seeing the incarnation as an utterly unique and unrepeatable thing. So it had ancient examples. It also has modern. And like I said, in New Age stuff, and you know, there was like in the 60s and 70s when people first started talking about New Age stuff, Age of Aquarius and things like that. And there was like, here was this thing that was New Age, right? Now I'm afraid, you see it all the time. You see it everywhere. There's people just kind of, people who would not even really know what the term New Age means. And yet so much of this thinking has been so inculcated in our culture that a lot of Christians think this way without even really looking within oneself to see divinity within me is salvation and growth and health. That is panentheism. And again, you see how one's, to get back to the subject of anthropology, what is a human being? How that roots that understanding of humanity in myself. My own experiences, my own feelings, my own preferences, my own self exploration. Okay, then the any questions about that or comments before we?
A couple things that came to mind when I was down at Casper Reentry Center. The Native Americans, they would speak about their religions, and they would speak of like things like rocks having spirits,
and right? And the Great Spirit, which is the source of it all, right?
So would that be more just the pantheistic?
Typically, what you see is that's I'm not super familiar with Native American theology, so I wouldn't want to speak out of turn, but it would be somewhere in that whole pantheism or panentheism or some variation of the two.
And then the other one I was thinking about is I remember reading Grapes of Wrath in high school.
Yeah.
And the one real famous line is when the reverend comes around and he says all that lives is holy, and of course John Steinbeck was a famous humanist.
Right.
So would humanism fit into like the pantheism?
Humanism can be a couple of different things, and it kind of depends on. And one of the things is it's interesting the way the pantheistic or panentheistic perspective and the materialistic perspective that we're going to talk about next.
Okay.
Those things sound like opposite things.
Okay.
But they kind of end up becoming the same.
Okay.
When you hear Carl Sagan, a very famous materialist, wax rhapsodic about the universe with its billions and billions of, you know, he's divinizing the universe. You know, he ends up becoming, you know, that our purpose what's the dude, the science guy, Neil deGrasse Tyson. That's what I'm thinking of. He says, you know, that, and he talks about this whole, you know, supernovas. And this is a good segue into our next one. So the supernovas, the stars explode, all this matter comes out. That matter seeds the galaxies, it makes the planets. Out of that comes all these complex chemical reactions, end up causing life, ends up evolving, ends up with us being conscious. And now here we are, studying stars, supernovas, chemical reactions, the origins of life, that we are the way the stars become self-aware and realize their purpose. Doesn't that sound sweet? You know, I mean, it sounds very stirring, doesn't it? Honestly, give the guy credit. He's eloquent. That is a materialistic perspective. But you see how they kind of, he ends up divinizing the world, divinizing the cosmos. The materialistic perspective, it was best known as Epicureanism in the ancient world. Those are kind of the two big, Stoicism on the one hand, which was panentheistic, and Epicureanism, which was materialistic. Epicurus taught that there was no soul, there was no spirit, there were no angels, there were no gods. All there was is matter. All there is stuff, physical stuff. And the physical stuff can be really complicated, you know, but it's all just ultimately physical. And it's all ultimately physical, which also means that it's all determined, because everything just follows physical laws. And ultimately then, to say one action is good or one action is bad is like saying, well, what's a more moral atom, a hydrogen or a helium atom, which is better? They're just different, right? You can decide for yourself, you like this and you don't like that, but it's all just preference, ultimately. You like pleasure and you don't like pain, unless you're one of those dudes that does like pain, you know, then it's just, but it's all just stuff. And all of this getting all, you know, worked up about eternity and souls and the afterlife and all of this transcendent purpose, it just distracts you from actually making the most of your life right now, because that's actually the only thing that matters. The only thing that matters is your life right now, because when you die, then you're going to be gone. You're going to end. You are really just. And so even the idea that you can make something of your life is really illusion, because we all just follow these natural laws. So go for it. Do what you want. You know, have a good life. But don't think it actually matters. That was Epicurus's. I'm simplifying a great deal. Epicurus was a smart dude. His philosophers was the one that he talked a lot about matter. And part of the implications of all of that is if you are a pantheist, if you are a Platonist, then you believe in eternal ideas, right? Capital I ideas, which are principles and truths that underlie all of reality, and the reality is echoes of. So there is the idea of justice, for example, and justice is a thing that has a tangible, concrete existence in the mind of God. And that human existence, to one degree or another, does a good job of encapsulating justice as it exists in the ideas, right? And so too with mercy or love or even things like a dog. A dog is, there is the idea, there is the ideal dog, which is an idea that exists in the mind of God. Every actual dog only corresponds to that dog to some greater or lesser degree, which is why you can look at a dog and know what it is, even if it has three legs. You could look at a three-legged dog and still say that's a dog, even though it's dog. You could say dogs have four legs. That dog only has three legs, but it's still a dog, because even though it doesn't correspond perfectly to the idea of dog, it still does to some degree. Epicurus said, oh, that's nonsense. That's stupid. He says, in fact, all of those categories are just mental illusions, conceptions that we put on things in order to make sense of them. So, for example, he says, here's a question. If I say 2 + 2 = 4, is that an actual truth? Or is that just a mental tool that we use to make sense of the world? If you'd say the first, you're a Platonist. If you're, they say the second, then you're an Epicurean. So, he would say 2 + 2 = 4 is just a mental construct. What you have is, say you have two apples, then you have two more apples, and now you have four apples. But they're still all different apples. No two of those apples are the same, right? So you still have these two apples and those two apples, and just because I put them closer together doesn't change them. They're still these two apples and those two apples. It doesn't. It's just a mental construct. It's an illusion again to say that now you have four apples. What you actually have is these particular four apples. It's materialism. Any human being, again, to say there is such a thing as a human being is just a mental construct. What there is Matt Powell and Sam Clare and Hannah Visser, and our differences and uniqueness and individuality is far more important than we have anything in common. I am me and you are you. You can't just kind of lump them together into this one category and say that a human being is a certain kind of thing. Because, for one thing, human beings are in flux. Human beings used to be different than they are now. He believed in something like evolution. You can see how relevant this is to the materialistic worldview that so many have today. If you believe in evolution, then to say there is such a thing as human nature is essentially an illusion. It's a mental construct. And particularly in the language of today's critical theory and so forth, it's a mental construct that probably only exists so that you can exercise power over someone else. I can say a man or a woman is a particular thing. A human being is a particular thing. And they would say, the only reason you're saying that is because you want to force me to conform to your idea of what a human being ought to be. Instead, let me have my own story. Let me have my own experience. Let me have my own identity. That's the thing that matters. And you can't invalidate someone else's identity because everybody's different. Everybody's got their own story. That's nominalism. Nominalism being the idea that, again, categories of things just don't exist because everything is material. A category is a non-material thing, right? To say such a thing as justice, what is justice? What is the material reality of justice? There is none. It's a mental construct. Therefore, justice does not exist. What actually exists is one particular organism treating another particular organism a particular way, causing them pleasure or pain. Anything else is just a power play. It's just an attempt to exert power over another human being. I use these mental constructs to try and control people and trap people. There was a song on one of the Police's early albums. Da-do-do-do-da-da-da-da, it was called. It's actually a really profound song. I mean, poets, priests, and politicians have words to thank for their positions. Words they... How does it... Poets, priests, and politicians have words to thank for their positions. The idea is, with their eloquence, they praise you, but their logic ties you up and rapes you. You know, it was the idea of people who use words. And so he says, da-do-do-do-da-da-da, that's all I've got to say to you. You know? Now, the irony of it is that Sting is a smart guy and uses words all the time to make the points he wants to make and then denies that he does so. But that's the point of the song, and it expresses a really powerful, it's postmodernism, basically. Postmodernism, which flows right out of evolutionary Darwinistic thinking, and it's that there is no spiritual reality, there are no souls, there is no afterlife, there are no gods, there are no demons. All there is the material world. And if all there is the material world, then I am not fundamentally different than a dog or a rock, right? I am just a different collection, arrangement of atoms and protons and neutrons, right? Therefore, once again, what does my life mean? You should know the answer by now. What does my life mean? It means nothing. Means nothing at all. Your life has, and therefore, if your life is to have any meaning, you must decide what it is. Only you can decide the meaning of your life, because it's otherwise fundamentally absurd. All human philosophy dead ends in absurdity. It ends one way or another. And you see how actually, it ends up, it's a paradox, an irony, that because the result of that goes back to the old lie. You shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. If only I can decide what my life means, then I am the God of my own universe. I decide what my life means. I am sovereign over my own life. Nobody else can tell me what my life means. Nobody else can tell me what my identity is. Nobody else can tell me that I ought to be this way and not that way. You shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. It's the old lie. It just gets dressed up in a lot of sophisticated philosophical language. Now, do you understand, as that idea has taken complete dominance in our society, how a statement like, I am a man trapped in a woman's body, could be a statement that could actually make sense? Or a woman trapped in a man's body? Because of the way that people construct their identities. It is no secret, it is no surprise, that people's, if I am constructing my own identity, that my sexual desires would have a lot to say about what that identity is going to be. Because those are very powerful drives within us. They're not the only ways people construct their identities. People construct their identities in all sorts of ways. Those are just some of the powerful ones. But at its root, there's some idea, again, that some idea that either everything is divine or nothing is divine. The biblical idea that there is a God who made creation, who made man to be in covenant with him, who made man to be a particular kind of thing that reflected his glory in a particular way, and that our actual physical, intellectual, emotional makeup was intended to reflect that. In its perfection, that changes the way I think about human identity. Changes it fundamentally. Because now, my identity cannot be constructed by looking within myself. My identity must be constructed properly by looking outward to the God that made me. Okay? That's the difference between biblical anthropology and everything else. At the end of the day. Any questions or discussion? We're going to end there for the day. We want to get into, in the coming weeks, we want to get into specifically how God created man, what it means that he's in the image of God, what God created man for, what it means that God created man male and female, how that went wrong in the fall, how it's being restored in Christ.
Are we going to cover anthropological implications of Islamic views?
Islamic views. That might take us a little further afield than I intended to go. I mean, we could spend a long time talking about. Yeah, Islam definitely has a particular anthropology.
Okay.
It's a distortion of Christian anthropology.
Okay.
It would be closer to Christian anthropology than paganism, for example. But Islam is essentially a Christian heresy. It's the right way to view Islam is as a Christian heresy. It all flows out of Christian thinking, just twisted and mixed up with other stuff. So we might get a chance to talk about that. Some of that would be interesting. I don't know that I understand the Islamic view of anthropology all that well, though. So I would want to be careful. Anything else? All right. Well, thanks for your attention. Let's have a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for your blessings. Thank you for the revelation of your truth that you created us. You created us to be in relationship with you. Created us to be your image bearers, your vice regents, ruling in your place on earth under your authority. Lord, we pray that as that you would reveal these truths to us as you're restoring your creative vision for what the universe and mankind was supposed to be, that you would help us to see the truth and guide us and teach us so that we would understand better and better who we are as people made in the image of God. I thank you and praise you for all that you have done for us in Jesus' name. Amen.